Welcome back. Today, we're diving into the second of our three-part podcast series that we're calling our Big Brain Series. So buckle up, everyone, because we're going to explore the issues around climate, climate action, and climate solutions through a very powerful lens, what we call the Big Brain Thinking Lens. Thinking in a big-brained way is thinking about ideas and concepts, big ideas, so that we can understand our place in the world, the problems we are creating, and the opportunities we can generate to build solutions. The time is now. It's critical, everyone. It's time to step up our game. Hi, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth. Please join me in welcoming a return guest and a big brain thinker, my friend Skip. His name is actually John A. Skip Leitner. We're going to go into that in another show someday. International resource economist, past president of the Association for Environmental Studies and Sciences, and a current University of Arizona instructor. Also with us is another big brain thinker, and I know that from several conversations we've had, and a true advocate for critical thinking for our younger generation. Please join me in welcoming Julie Huber, CEO of SARCEF, and we're going to tell you what SARCEF is. So welcome both of you, and can you tell that I'm excited to have you come and inspire our guests and inspire me and join us in being a part of climate solutions for this great planet of ours. And I just have to do this, and I just do. I thought about it again, but I'm not going to share all there is to know about both of your backgrounds because some of it you probably wouldn't want shared, at least in Skip's case. But I do want to talk about a little bit more about both of you so that people have a sense for just who we have here that I'm going to be picking your big brains. Julie, as I said, is the CEO of SARCEF, which is the Southern Arizona Research, Science, and Engineering Foundation. She promotes the development of future critical thinkers and problem solvers. What a big job. Previously, she served as TGen's Manager of Education and Outreach, where she increased the community's working knowledge of genomics and educated, trained, and inspired the next generation of researchers and physicians. Big brain stuff. She holds a BA in anthropology and English, yay, with a minor in biology from Indiana University, and earned her MA in anthropology with a focus on bioarchaeology from ASU. And we're still going to love you because I know ASU, Arizona State University, is doing a lot of big brain stuff. And I'm proud that they are in our state. Skip is an international resource economist, which I said, who leads a team of consultants, the Economic and Human Dimensions Research Associates, based here in Tucson. He is the past president of the Association of Environmental Studies and Sciences, another big job. It's an independent, interdisciplinary professional association in higher education. Skip is also the former director of economic and social analysis for the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. He previously served almost 10 years as a senior economist for technology policy for the United States Environmental Protection Agency, as we all know, as the EPA. And I encourage all of you to read about them both on the MGW show notes page because they bring a lot to the table. So let the big brain activation begin. Thanks Yoo-hoo. For being here, Ooh. Both of you. Woohoo!
Out of the starting blocks.
Yeah, here we go. Like I'm chomping at the bit. I wanted to turn over to both of you because this show is all about education and more specifically, the importance of and ways to bolster more inquisitive science experiences in grades K through 12, all of which we know will be a really positive step for meaningful climate crisis action and conversation. So, Julie, I'd like to start with you because you're kind of the epitome of all that I just said. So tell us a little bit about SARCEF. We don't want to make the show about SARCEF, but it's really important that people know what your work is and what you're doing because they might be wanting to have a SARCEF in their school district or their town or their city in the not-too-distant future. So what is it and why does it matter?
I appreciate that opportunity. Thank you. SARCEF is actually an organization that's mission is creating Arizona's next generation of critical thinkers and problem solvers through science and engineering. And that ordering is really intentional. Yes, we're about science, we're about engineering, we're about the whole STEM, but really the core of it is that when you learn science and engineering as tools, they can help you no matter what you do in your life because it develops skills like critical thinking and problem solving. So that's what we're really looking to develop in our state. But science and engineering are really important tools to do that.
And we're behind. We don't have to go into that, but we need you. We need SARSEF. And when I think about it, to me, there's critical thinking and memorization. Pretty much, it's like two divides. And so in school, we teach kids to memorize answers for tests, sadly. Lots of stress, lots of money, lots of focus on what their grades are. When, in fact, if we engage them in critical thinking, they'd probably sail through those tests.
Oh, isn't that true? And the curiosity of it. To me, I see science when I look out across Tucson and see all the beautiful yellow in the Palo Verdes that are blooming right now. I see science when I see a new car on the road that's doing something incredible and is more efficient. There's so much that's live and incredible about science and engineering. And when it's really just about memorization, how do you really get in touch with that? So allowing students to really tap into their natural curiosity lets them be very natural scientists and engineers.
Instead of shutting it down. And I was telling you both a story about my granddaughter and what her imagination teaches me. I forgot because she just, if you let it go, she goes. She really goes. So Skip, it was critical to you when we were laying out the content for this series that we talk about kids, their education, about the importance of incorporating science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, as part of our core curriculum in our schools. Why is that for you? Why is critical thinking from your perspective as a globally recognized and respected economist? Why did you want to cover an entire podcast on how important this is?
Yeah, darn good question, Gina. And as I was listening to Julie a moment ago here, I thought as I was in the kitchen yesterday fixing my dinner, I was actually a kitchen chemist more than just a cook. And as I was fixing up the house, I was actually more like a wildlife biologist trying to maintain an integral part of my life as we're living it together. But the problem is we're only seeing our house and not in the bigger world, as Julie just said, seeing the Palo Verde blossoming and all the lively things going out beyond our world, but we're so unaware of them. And then reading a study by the British University not too long ago, 8 out of 10 people, high school, college, are worried about the future, whether climate, the environment. But if they had a better understanding of science and engineering, they might also see opportunities to deal with the problem in the moment, immediately, instead of fretful that they don't know what to do. So the more we get that critical thinking out there, the more we really spend time encouraging as a community, and not just students alone, but students together with a larger community, I think we've got a lot more hope ahead of us.
And it matters. It matters so much. Julie, do you want to add anything to that? Because I've got lots of questions.
Oh, just that it's, you're so right. And I see so many students start their science journey in the kitchen. And I think that really brings out that science and engineering is all around you. And you don't have to start with, you know, going and seeing a fancy lab or seeing science as something separate from you. It's all around you. And that's really a big part of what SARSEF outreach is in schools, is first helping students see the science and engineering all around them and then just to get curious and ask questions. Because when they ask questions that they care about, they really build their STEM identities and are more thoughtful about how science and engineering interacts with their own lives.
Oh, you just made me think that STEM is not just a four-letter word. It's really some positive things going along with it.
Imagine.
Really, a lot of things stem from that. We're not going to even go there, Gina. We're not going to go there. So one of the things I was thinking about in preparing for this show is, I call it the flip side, because a lot of kids that are getting trained in like energy efficiency programs and recycling and not using plastic in schools, is there a positive flip side to this? Julie, we'll start with you, where kids are actually helping with their parents with critical thinking or changes or even consciousness around some of these issues. Do you see that if kids focus on it, there's a ripple effect for their parents?
Oh, absolutely. And I think a little later on, I'll talk about some of the science fair data that I've pulled up from some of SARSEF's work. But yes, the students care a lot and they are looking to answer big questions and to continue on with that. And that does flow to the adults, but I'm certainly not one to stop there. Us adults have a lot of responsibilities too. it's really important that we build cultures of STEM, not only in schools, but in everything that those students go to. If they go home and hear a very well-meaning, oh, don't worry, I wasn't good at science, I wasn't good at math, so you may not be either, and that's okay. I understand why parents would say that. It's very protective. It comes from a place of love. But if we actually equip parents with the tools to be a coach in STEM, like they could be a coach in, say, a sport, then that changes everything. And it gives those students more opportunities to address those big questions and to do a lot of that big thinking.
Well, you remind me, when I was a youngster in high school, I was a baseball player, and my family would always come out to see the games. But when we did science fairs, nobody showed up at the science fair. It was like it was a different, a disconnected reality from being out there dancing or playing baseball or whatever it might be. So we've got to bring more of the science into the fun part of our lives together, like almost like we're investing in our future in a very big way.
Totally. And it's that, I love what you said, Julie, about it's got to be, we can't do things in silos anymore. If anything we've learned from climate crisis, it's like it happens. It's not going to happen over there, or it's not just the rain and it's not just the sun. We have to start thinking with much more integrated thought. So I'd like to hear from both of you. One of my favorite quotes that I got right because I Googled it, I've been saying it wrong. I've read studies about how people really abuse some of these sayings and what the original saying was. So children are the only future the human race has. And for me, that's a hard stop, period. It's the only future we have. And with that in mind, either one of you can start because you both have thoughts on this, I'm sure. How are we doing when it comes to our nation investing in our children's future, which is their education? I mean, I have my thoughts. I'm just the talent. Julie, you are boots on the ground. How are we doing when it comes to investing in STEM education, both here and around the country?
I appreciate how you put that because, yes, that children are our future. You hear that a lot. But I think if anything comes after that hard stop, it's okay, then adults, let's get busy and make sure we're yes. really supporting those students, those kids that are the future. So what we see across the country is just a lot of uneven playing fields. We see some schools that are really investing in STEM and in everything they can, from personnel to supplies. And we have others that have taken other foci. And it's not necessarily that they are intentionally putting science to the wayside, but we just expect so much from our schools, from our teachers. We know that teachers are just incredible. They should all wear capes. It's just amazing what they do, but they have so much on their plates. And that means sometimes science gets kicked off. And so when you pick a random school out of the country, that school may have incredible science opportunities and it may have none, really. Because SIRSEF will go into some schools where we know right now that we will be the only science that those elementary school students will get that year.
I think part of the problem is that we think about teachers and money for STEM and labs and supporting the students in so many different ways. We think of it more as a budget problem instead of thinking about expenditure for, say, good teachers. We need to be thinking about it as an investment in our people, in the kids, in our long-term well-being. So moving away from spending money to investing in our future, that needs to be where we head our way down the road.
You are bringing that up a lot. And I want people to hear it because it's really a good investment. It is money in the bank. The ROI is immeasurable in so many ways. And you have said, we have a moral imperative. And I love that. Think about it. A moral imperative, which I totally believe as a country, to make some pretty significant investments in a myriad of things, including technology, research, paying people more money to run programs, paying teachers a salary that they don't have to apply for food stamps or that they can't afford to have a home in people that are really experienced, educated. We've invested in their future training because it changes. So talk a little bit about that, Skip. Why can't we get there with understanding it's money well spent? Maybe the best way to spend money is investing in our kids.
Yeah, I think it's a darn good way to spend money, and it's our future that's at stake. Where, as I've said before, we're so much in the moment, so disconnected from the outside world. We have 100,000 to 200,000 people in the United States die every year from air pollution. That is more than car crashes and murders, and yet we don't think of air pollution as a problem that needs to be dealt with and people whose lives we can help in so many big ways. But if we step back and better understand the connection, for example, as a human being, I've got maybe 30 trillion cells in my body that make me a human being. But what people don't realize, I have 39 trillion microbes in my body as well that keep me alive, that help me become and maintain nourishment, help my body grow in positive ways. So it's that combination of the human and the microbes together. We think about bacteria as a negative thing. We don't understand that viruses and bacteria really can enable us to live much better lives if we're out in the world working with people that know how to be wildlife biologists, or as we said earlier, kitchen chemists, really being part of that proactive effort in our lives together. So kids need the support, and the parents need to support the kids, but we need to think about it as an investment in our future.
I get it. I really get it. And let's go back to the whole critical thinking conversation, because the way I see it, as someone that has not studied it intensively, don't quote me on this, it's my thought, instead of focusing on critical thinking as an educational entity in the country, we're focusing far less on it. Test scores, the fallout from that with kids' stress and stomach aches and missing school. Test scores is memorization. Critical thinking is pulling the lid off, like just let's have it. So, Julie, what's your assessment of how are we doing? Is it a key component here in this district, and you participate in national conferences, you stay connected? Is it valued outside of the education system? Because teachers sure value it.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good distinction that we're doing a lot of work working towards that test, but I know people value critical thinking and I see it, and it's just a matter of making sure that's really coming out clear in the classroom. And I know when those students get to high school and they're thinking about what they want to do next, as they're thinking about what they want to do as their job, their future employer cares if they can think critically, if they can look at a number and say, oh, you know, actually, that doesn't quite look right. I'm going to look at it again. These are important skills. They aren't going to just want them to read something and then do the same thing every day. So this is something that's really important to these students and their future. And, you know, as we've talked about, if it's important to our kids' future, it's important to our future and everything we'll be able to do.
Totally. And Skip, you're now teaching a class at the U of A, University of Arizona, and I want to know what your experience has been. They're the kids that came up through these education systems from all over the country. Are your students, are some of them critical thinkers? Are most of them? I think that some of the interviews I've done of late, some of the professors I've interviewed, they're not seeing it. They have to try to ignite the passion in their students who came up with having to study to pass a test. What's your assessment? I don't want you to say anything bad about your students because they might listen to this, but
I'm delighted
they're
to
so
say
passionate about it.
Yeah, my students are delightful. I've got almost 30 of them. And I was worried that, as one teacher told me, I was going to expect maybe one-third of them to be interested in a big way in the topic, one-third willing to be persuaded, and one-third who might want to be entertained. And I was going to have to overcome that hump. But in my case, the students are at a master's program in policy, public policy, or public administration. And as we've been engaging, I'm delighted to say they are coming forward with ideas, even those I don't grade as well as some. Every single student has had an interesting idea or a positive thought to suggest. Now, part of my job is to help enable them to move that forward into a practical outcome, not simply a good idea. But I'm delighted to say the students are stepping up. It could be because they're at a master's level and we've funneled some of them out.
Right.
But I think in this case, as Julie's already said, the kids are worried. They're really worried, and they're looking for ways to release and to enact a positive solution. So I think it's a positive statement if we, as a community, whether at the Tucson level or the U.S. level internationally, really get together and enable, encourage, and support this critical thinking.
So perfect segue to the science fair. For our listeners from around the country, I wish you could come visit to see what SARSEF does once a year, how massive, how much work it is, how many volunteers they need, how many kids are involved from all over. When I did it as a judge, Skip has been a judge, it blows my mind. It mostly gives me hope. So from your perspective, we had a brief conversation yesterday, which got me very excited about you, Julie, are not just taking it as a science fair, which from a developmental asset point of view is very important for these kids. It might change the trajectory of their life, working with other kids, solving a critical problem, and they get interested. Something is ignited inside of them. But you are really looking at it. You're doing some critical thinking when it comes to the science fair. So tell me about why that event matters and what you're trying to do, what I would call applied science or applied research, with what you're finding out from those experiences.
Oh, yeah. No, this is fun. I want to start with a little bit of history that the SARSF Fair actually started in 1955 on the University of Arizona campus.
What?
And that's why I call the SARSF Fair a Tucson tradition.
And I had important. No idea.
We get to celebrate student science and engineering every year as a community. And SARSF covers all of Southern Arizona. So this is an opportunity for not only students to be doing work, but to be celebrated for it, to be celebrated for doing big brain thinking. And that's important. It's not just what we're doing for those students, but it's the opportunity for a community to come together and recognize that's important. But about a decade ago, SARSF realized that it wasn't just about doing that SARSF fair. It's great to celebrate when students are doing science and engineering, but we had to broaden who had the opportunity to be doing it.
Love it. Love it.
And that's when SARSF became a year-round effort, going into classrooms, bringing on more programs that gave more students an opportunity to think critically through research projects. So, you know, if a student goes to SARSF Fair, great. If they don't, but they're doing research, also great. That fair is the icing on the cake. And it also is a really good litmus test to know what students are doing research. What are they interested in? And I want to speak to a few other benefits of that science fair and what the students go through when they do this. First of all, they get a chance to fail safely.
That's science.
That's science.
That is science.
That's huge.
You know, you're laughing, Skip. It's right. Am I right?
Yep.
That it's trying to make mistakes and finding out what works and what doesn't. I love that you brought that up. So go ahead.
And not only that, but they have adults like both of you saying, you
failed.
That's great.
We're so proud of you.
Yes. And it's not just the celebration from the community. It's the fact that a judge comes, listens to them, like their ideas matter because they do. But they have an adult that comes up to them that they know cares about science and is really smart and says, wow, this is amazing. You did this.
And it can be life-changing.
It's so cool. Yeah. Yeah. Just that interaction alone can be so important for a student.
Well, I got to tell you one quick story, Julie. Sorry to interrupt. But one of the students I judged at the fair 2 years ago, we talk about converting sunlight into electricity, photovoltaics. He had the idea of, couldn't we convert moonlight into electricity if we magnified the moonlight a bit more so that it shone upon a cell? I don't know if it'll work or not, but those are the kinds of questions we have to ask. And he may fail, he may succeed, but that he took the time and celebrated the opportunity to ask a different problem, look at the problem in an entirely different way.
That was
a good moment.
He'll start asking more things like that. Well, what about this? And what about that? And what about this? So any other points to that, Julie?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, I'm also thinking about the science fair and what else we can learn from it.
Using it actually as a data set.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. A piece of this is with the pandemic, we brought our science fair floor to a virtual platform.
Really?
And so, like many programs, we did see a decrease in how many projects were involved. In 2020, our fair happened really the week that we saw the impact of the pandemic in Arizona. So there was a bit of a whirlwind, but that was kind of our last number, and that was over 2,000 projects. Last year, we were at 1,100, but this year we're at about 1,500. So it's climbing faster than I expected, and I'm grateful for that, but we're going to keep climbing up again to get to our typical numbers and to get more students involved in this work. But having it as a virtual project floor makes it even easier for me to use it as a data set to see what kind of problems are students interested in solving.
Love it.
You know, I can't necessarily speak to why they pick it. There are a variety of reasons that they could pick this. But I look to see, okay, is each of these projects wanting to solve something bigger? And if it's not, it's okay. Sometimes it's more descriptive because that's where it's at. Sometimes it's a, ooh, what happens when I do this?
Right,
or,
right, right.
Oh, that's funny. And those are important projects too. But I really wanted to focus on the ones that were looking at solving big problems. Now, I've only been able to do this at the high school level. So that's about 217 projects. Of those, 85% are solving big problems.
Wow.
Really fabulous.
I don't ever want to stump the guest. Do you have a sense yet of what kinds of things they're looking at? I mean, is climate change one of them? Is water another one? Do you know that yet?
I am excited. I'm not going to disappoint you because I do have that data here.
Oh my gosh, that's really good.
So what I did is I kind of coded these projects. I went through each of the high school projects and I wanted to see, okay, what kind of big problem are they trying to solve? And I looked at their results and their discussion. And if they talked about really, this is how this applies, I was able to really put that in a category. And what I found was that 34% of these projects were about health.
Wow.
And
wow.
About 36% were about the environment.
Wow.
And the rest were
which are
out.
Inextricably bound. They yes. might not know it yet, but wow.
You need a healthy environment to have a healthy body.
Yep.
Yes, all the others were fairly evenly distributed across about 10, 11 other categories. But you can tell that the big hitters here are the environment and health. And then I took those two big categories and I split it down into kind of subcodes to be able to see what else are they looking at in there. And what I found was that in environmental work, about 18% are about climate change. 18% are about water, which won't surprise you since we're in Arizona. And 31% was about water.
Yes.
That's a big thing on
wow.
people's minds. And 18% was waste.
Wow.
Wow.
And, you know, you're talking about high school kids, and I'm just going to say this. I tell everybody, almost every show I mention it, that I'm 71. Do you know what? I wasn't thinking about any of that in high school. I was probably thinking, number one, about boys, because that made me normal. But it was fun. I'm not one of those kids that made up my high school experience was fun. But when I did the science fair, what made me really like sad at some level and excited at another, it was like a whole schizophrenic response, is that the heaviness that there is involved with kids thinking. There's a lot of things that they are having to face. It's proven that kids are having anxiety about climate change and about all of these issues. And I had such a free childhood, like free. I'm not kidding. We played. We went and played kick the can outside. And my parents had us go out in nature. And even that is at risk. So I just want to like press pause here for a minute and applaud you for taking it to the next level, to doing your critical thinking and saying, that's great, we had a good science fair. What are they saying? How are we going to use it? What are they excited about? What are they worried about? I think that's amazing.
Learned it from the kids. Doesn't that just show you?
There you go. There were so many times when I wish we were on video so that they could see the smile on your face and obvious reflective of your passion and your commitment to what you're doing. So let's twist it a little bit now. And I'm looking at you, Skip, right? Here we are. What is the risk if we don't really start aggressively investing in big brain stuff? That's a really articulate word. What if we don't pump up the volume? You are a world-recognized economist. I don't want to pump up your ego because you don't have a big one, in my opinion. no, it's you have a healthy one, and that really matters. What's at risk for us as a nation? Because that's where I think people might pay attention. As a country, it weakens us. And we are weaker and weaker. I used to puff up. You were the first the United States of America. We're first in this and first in that and first in that. We're not. We're not right. First in anything except pollution right now, I think. Sorry.
Yeah, healthcare, education, we're not number one, according to a number of the developed economies.
Oh, yeah.
We're way down the list. But what's happening already, I mentioned the last time you and I spoke, last year alone, we had over $140-some billion of damages from climate change. And if my numbers are right, by 2040, that's going to rise to three times that amount, maybe a total of $5 trillion cumulative dollars in damages to our economy, which doesn't include the damages to lost income or health or other problems associated with that kind of a distraught outcome. So that's the first thing. But secondly, we're actually getting less efficient as an economy. We don't use things as the same productive way as we might, and we need more of the thinking that comes from students, from adults supporting students as we come up with new innovations, new ideas. The cell phone that we have now relies on over 200,000 patents over the last couple decades to get us to where we are, and we're getting even so much more complicated that we need more in the way of contributions from young folks, from adults who've got some skills and can work with young folks together in a collaborative way. And as you said, come out of those silos and begin working together. One of my favorite projects in the whole world is the CERN reactor out in Switzerland, the Large Hadron Collider. It's the biggest machine in the world. It took 100,000 people working together over a number of years, over 100 countries. Their first language was physics. Their mother tongue was their second language.
And I didn't get invited?
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, it's... The fact that actually it's 10,000 people from 100 countries, I got that wrong. So it is the willingness to ask questions, the willingness to be open, the willingness to connect, the willingness to fail and learn from that failure and turn it right around and bring some new tasks forward. But as an economy, as a so-called superpower in the world, we are actually seeing a slow erosion of our economy. The infrastructure is beginning to suffer. We're not keeping up in the growth of patents as we might be able to do, need to do if we're going to stay ahead. We're producing 85,000 chemical elements in this country to try to bring things like plastics or fertilizers or things for medical purposes and things like that, but we don't know how to manage them as well as we might. We don't understand the various interactions it might have with the environment around us, whether it's the atmosphere, whether it's the land, whether it's the water, what have you. So we are at a moment, and we've talked about this before, we are facing either a hard decade or we're going to have a very bad century. So we've got not just to talk about it and start doing it, we've got to step up the ante and start working with students, start working with the community at large, and really encourage, again, thinking of this as an investment, not simply as an expenditure, not simply as something we got to put up with, but for the well-being of our kids and the community at large.
And you and I have talked about this. We've talked about a lot, but I do want to write another book, and I want to call it The Humanitarian Party. Because to me, when you're talking about this, and we talk about the great divide in this country now, let's just say between Democrats and Republicans, if we could break it down to some of the lowest common denominators, Republicans say they want to have fair returns, they don't want to pay as much taxes, you know, whatever they say, whatever Democrats say, sometimes to their detriment, free this, free that, no accountability. Those are gross generalizations on my part. What I hear in this conversation is that it's a humanitarian party that we're talking about, because is there anything worse to waste than a brain, a child's brain? There is nothing. And when you got to me about big brain thoughts and big brain series, what you said about the, are we preparing for a hard decade or a
bad century?
When I ask people to listen to our last show very intentionally, that's one of the things that stuck with them, that if we don't really pay attention and put the money, we're spending money, oh, God knows we're spending money, but where? And like you said, the efficiencies in that matter so much, because there isn't a better investment than in a little young person's brain.
Well, let's put it, I've talked about this before as well, the old Darwinian notion, survival of the fittest. Actually, what the scientists are finding is survival of the friendliest, those species that cooperate with each other, contribute to each other.
Love it.
Whether they're sharing underground, under the soil, as trees might be exchanging phosphorus or nitrogen or carbon dioxide, and information. They pass information on under the ground. We don't even begin to see it. So it's survival of the friendliest together with the investment in our future, not just seeing it as a budget problem, but as a real investment that helps the kids move forward, even as it helps all of us move forward in a very big way.
So exciting. It's so exciting. Julie, do you want to take a stab at that? Because you are boots on the ground. I love that. And you, what's at risk if we don't do it? And quickly and intentionally and with big bucks.
Well, I want to go back to this data and actually ask you.
No, you can't stop the stop the host. What?
Sorry, Gina. So I mentioned that health was the other big thing that students were looking at. Of course, there were two topics within health that students were interested in. one being COVID. Well, what do you think was a little higher than COVID?
Clean air. Nope.
Do you have a guess, Skip?
That'd be my guess.
Mental health.
Oh gosh, mental I have health. Goosebumps.
It gets right back to the university in Britain, worrying about the future.
Truly.
And feeling so uncertain and so misplaced in so many ways, right?
And, you know, this is what you were talking about before, of feeling these mixed emotions of, yes, they're having to think about mental health, and that's hard. That's hard for us to think about. But also, they're talking about mental health. They're not sweeping it under a rug. They're worried about it. They're thinking about their friends. They want to collaborate. They want to worry. We're thinking about each other, too. So there is a silver lining to this, that it means that students want to talk about it and not just to put it under the rug. But it does mean that it's something that they see their peers facing.
And if we give them the means to think about it, the means to act on it, that's going to go a long way to help their mental health in a very big way.
And when you layer COVID on top of that, which is a lot of the impetus for severe mental health issues, increase in mental health issues, increase of depression among kids, and on, it's. I love that you brought that in. My daughter and I volunteered at the NAMI walk, National Alliance of Mental, I'm not even sure what NAMI stands for, but I loved it. I cried almost the whole time, tears of joy. I love my tears, but seeing the parents and the children and the signs of this person died and this person killed themselves, and seeing the support in this community for really no shame. That was the message. No shame, no blame, mental health needs to come out from under any rock, any rug, anywhere, and talk about it. I love that you brought that up.
And I love bringing that attitude to how we think about the climate and the little things that we can do. It's not always about, it's not about the shame of what we're not doing, but it's what we can do. And really balancing what we can do in our lives and being really bringing that hope in there too.
Yeah, yep, hope. Boy, that NAMI gave me hope. I'm telling you that right now. I was sailing, and we already signed up for next year, and we want to really be involved, and I want some of their shirts because the messages are great. So I can't have this discussion about bringing up one of my biggies, and I'm sure it's biggies to you, and it's what I said, the great divide that I think is widening, and it's about, maybe it's widening, because there's so much conversation about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I just want to tell you a little story about my experience this week. I went to visit an elementary school here in Arizona, and it was in what would be demographically described as a lower income, more at-risk neighborhood, beautiful school. And we were there to film the STEM lab that was provided by Tucson Electric Power and the Marshall Foundation. The principal was a total frickin' rock star. She's like, I just wanted to be around. She was like the Energizer Bunny. They didn't have a STEM lab. Strike one. All those brains for the kids that don't have it. It's fun. There were robots, and they're building robots and all these little things that were walking around in a 3D machine so they can create things like that. Talk about taking the lid off and critical thinking. So I was sad because her school does not have the money to put a STEM lab together. It had to be outside funding. Thank you, TEP and the Marshall Foundation. I called both my friend Jane at the Marshall Foundation and called somebody at TEP and said, I don't know who to thank, but thank you, Wendy Erica Worden. And then she said, you know, one of the challenges is we would like to have a STEM teacher. So my first question is, do you both see the great divide continuing? Because to me, those are like lost lives, literally lost brains. We're training them to be really good servers at McDonald's, and they might be like a doctor that finds a cure for the next epidemic, that they might get involved in that if we gave them the environment in which to learn and critically think. So do you have a sense, have you done a data set on, I'm teasing her, but I mean, I'm so thrilled and touched that you have that, on is there still, from what you see, a great divide here and nationally in terms of, you know, in our state, in our town, the Foothills, they've got it all. They've got STEM lab, they've got STEM teachers out in Vail. It's unbelievable what they're building. And it's all based on the tax base. So they have it because they have Raytheon people salaries. And up here in the Foothills, where I used to live, they've got the tax base. Whatever they want, they get. So that's great, but it's not for the greater good. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And going through the pandemic, seeing impacts from climate change, we know that when these things happen, they run along the lines of the pre-existing lines of inequality. That as these things happen, it really deepens that schism that you're talking about. And so it's something we have to be really intentional about and think about and put a lot of effort into. And I want to go back to something that Skip had said earlier, and that's that investment in people, in that science is everywhere and a STEM lab is such a great resource, and it's building to that environment of what's around students that they can engage with in STEM. But without the people and the relationships, it can be really difficult to then bring in the scientific process, engineering practices, to really bring that to life and to build the tools to use it in a way that students can really dig into those big problems that they
want to
solve.
Maybe that's the first step forward, is to think about this as investing in our future for the sake of our future, for the sake of our kids. Without that investment, it ain't going to happen.
I knew that, you know, preparing for the week, that both of you were going to spend time with me. So it heightened my awareness of everything that was going on out there with the STEM lab. And things that I know are important from my family's experience, my grandson was very active. If his mother wasn't more educated and proactive, he would have been on medication. That's what they said. He's so busy in the classroom and he can't sit still. One teacher got him a bean bag because he kept falling off his chair. He couldn't sit still. I mean, and now you should see what he's doing. So the STEM lab at Maldonado, it was pretty. It had a great rug that said STEM. It was colorful. It had chairs that were balls. It was so exciting for kids who have multiple learning modalities to come in there and feel welcome and not singled out and not acting out. This principal and that environment, it just, they had it all to create a successful learning environment. That's what we're talking about, where all kids succeed, not just the science brains, because I was not one of them. Skip, is there anything you want to add to that?
Spot on.
Spot on. It really is. I wish both of you had been with me and say, look at this, look at this. It's just what you're talking about. It's what you stand for. So, Julie, is there such a thing as a STEM teacher? Like, what is your take on that? Because I would be great as an English teacher, as a science teacher, not so much. So is there special training for STEM teachers? What is a STEM teacher?
I see a lot of variability across districts. So instead, I would talk about it of how we can ensure every teacher feels comfortable being a science teacher. Because we have seen that teachers don't get as much training in science. You know, you go into an elementary school classroom and they're an expert on everything. And science, as long as we keep it as something that's intimidating, it's going to continue to be that. And if the teacher doesn't feel prepared to teach it, the students are going to feel that too.
Fear.
And so being able to really empower those teachers to feel really strong in those areas is a big key part. If you inspire one student, you inspire one student. You give the teacher the resources and opportunities they need and think about all of the students they're going to impact. So really, I think that that's key. And I think that for when you have subject-specific teachers, making sure they have the opportunities to stay up to date about what's really cool and exciting and interesting in science, those things are going to make a big difference.
And even in talking, it just hit me. I like to do this. Like, this is why I wish we had video. Maybe Elon Musk is going to find my... going to fund my studio. Very funny. But it's like this just in, is that when I speak from my experience, when science was taught for me, it was a lot of memorization about scientific terms. It wasn't a lot of experiential stuff. Biology, different, but it made me very queasy. I did not like cutting up a little baby pig. But it was my experience that colors my thinking, because now when you said that, if I look through the lens of, for example, went to the Cooper Center at the University of Arizona, went out there, visited my friend Colin Waite, they bring life to science.
Great program. Yeah.
Life. It's like, I love being out in nature, and they incorporate it in a fun, open, some of these kids have never been out of their neighborhood environment, but it is science and it is math and it is engineering. They are able to give that experience to kids that makes kids want to learn more. It doesn't shut down their lizard brain.
You know, I just saw some passion in you that makes me think you'd actually be a pretty good science teacher if you wanted to be.
You know, I'm thinking about my next thing, and everybody's saying to me, you know, like, I'm going to slow things down. I haven't made an official announcement. It's no secret, but I'm going to really slow down at the end of June and focus entirely on training with clients that really want more systemic change in their organizations, which excites me. So that's a big thing. But I'm thinking about what's next, even though some people are saying, next is you taking a brain break. Let your big brain play with Rooney, which is also awesome. So it's really something that I'm very interested in. I love kids and I love working with them. So that guess what happens? They love it too. They feel it. They really feel that sense.
Well, let me add just a couple things, because I really like the way Julie laid it out, that you provide the training to the teachers so they feel comfortable talking about science.
Confidence.
But to the extent that happens, they also need to be engaged with their colleagues and beyond the classroom. So there needs to be opportunities to talk and share experiences with each other. And my own sister is a science teacher. She retired a couple years ago in Denver. I cannot tell you how much money she's had to spend out of her own budget to provide the materials, the things that kids use in classrooms to do the tests and things like that. Again, bringing forward the opportunity, the training, but the interaction, and then to support the physical reality of books,
what it
of
takes.
Materials, what it takes to actually do the test to get the job done, and then to celebrate and have fun with it.
So here's the $64,000 question. And I don't think that even has relevance anymore. It dates me because there used to be a show. That was the $64,000 question. It was probably 4 decades ago.
That's $128,000 now.
$2.5 million.
Yeah.
Dollar question. So you both know, I know, change doesn't happen. People make change happen. And sometimes that thought can be so overwhelming. And my invitation to people is change begins just like any journey. With a single step. It's how you eat an elephant with one bite. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So in an effort to not overwhelm listeners but inspire them, I'd like both of you to reflect on what can someone listening, my listeners are all world, and I get emails, I have it brought up in conversations. They're engaged. If you're listening to Mrs. Green's World, like you care about the planet, you care about the shows, the content, and all of that. What, for people who care deeply about our climate crisis, it's the biggest thing I care about, without question. What would you say to people listening, one thing they could do or some action they could involve with? Because it's not just people changing their own habits. I believe we have to have policy changes. I believe we have to get much more involved with our elected officials so that they're funding the things that you talk about. It's such a disgrace. So what would your call to action be, Skip, for people listening? If you can come up with one or two or three things.
I'd say go to the SARSF solar race in the near future. And he's got kids.
People
high school
around
kids.
The country can't do that. We have to
well,
do something
but they
for
can
everybody.
Imagine it, and they can look it up, and they right. can encourage in right, their right. own school districts these kinds of things where
great.
Kids are testing cars using sunshine, solar rays on the cars that are powering the vehicles instead of gasoline. Go out and celebrate and actually check out what the kids are doing and bring a smile to their face.
Like you would a marathon. If someone's running in a marathon, show up for support. I hear what you're saying.
So exactly
that's,
right.
Okay. And I agree with you. It's like when we talk about something local, it's think globally, act locally. So I love that we're talking about SARSF because there should be SARSFs in every school all around the country. And I actually believe, because I want to, that there are people that listen and say, I could do that in my school, or I could do that in my neighborhood, or I could start this kind of campaign. So Julie, what's your response to that? What would you like to see activated in people that would help support your smile, your vision, and your heart?
Well, first of all, thank you for talking about racing the sun. I love that.
I do too. I do too. And I haven't talked about it in ages, but I was aware of it a long time ago. I'm still in shock that SARSF started in 1955 when I was just 5. Okay, so go ahead.
Yes, I appreciate that. I agree with it. And to take a different angle with it, there are organizations doing great science education, engineering work. So find the organizations that are making a difference in your community and how can you support them? If it's through a donation, if that's something you can do, or through your time, that's where you can put a lot into this collective action of making your work matter just that much, because the community is supporting it and putting it into that big effort.
And even just cheering them on.
Exactly.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that would be my second piece, is when a kid asks you, why is the sky blue, or what is this rock? Whatever those seemingly silly questions are, give them the time of day. Sit with them, ask them more questions, get their minds thinking about it, and just make sure they know how smart they are.
It's just, it makes me really want to cry. I'm not going to cry right now, but I think about how we have so much brain power. And I know, like, when I started one of my businesses, I used an organization that's dedicated, it's retired professionals that helped me write my business plan and all of that stuff. Just great minds giving back. There's so much untapped potential. And this is the thing about giving back. And I do that. What I do is teach about creating cultures of sustainability. That's our training. A core of that is getting engaged in your community and giving back. That's what creates sustainable communities, is not just about me and my yard and my house and my kids, but really creating those connections and a culture of sustainability. So everybody can do a little. And companies like, I mean, I do say TEP and some other big ones, they foster volunteerism because we need it. Obviously, we're not paying for everything. We're spending money on different things, but it's really important that we foster that in us and that our kids see it. My kids all volunteer, and that's because we did. My husband and I did. It's not what we said, oh, you have to volunteer when you grow up. They saw us. So it creates that. It becomes...
And I second that emotion.
Yes. Yes. So... do we feel complete? Is there anything else? I mean, I loved it, and I cannot believe that the time flew. I do say that frequently, and that speaks volumes about the quality of the guests we have and their messages and how engaged I got. I'm not sitting here wondering, you know, when is this going to be over? I'm thinking, do we have more time? Is there anything, final thoughts that you want to share or shout out or anything, or do you feel complete?
I think it says it all. I like what Julie's laid out, and I like the way you've responded, and I'm going to just let it go at that.
Okay, Julie?
Well, I just want to say thank you to both of you for this opportunity to talk to you, and thank you to every volunteer, every donor, every organization that supported SARSF, and every student that has stretched their minds to do something incredible through our programs.
Big thumbs up.
The joy that they will get, that's the thing. Like this NAMI thing, we had to be there at 6:30 in the morning. And I said to my daughter, I said, didn't they have like an 8:30 shift? I could not tear myself away. We were among the last to leave. So next year, we're signing up for the early shift. It was so, and my point is, if you take that step, even though I was Wendy the whiner on the way there, the rewards, the feeling of doing something that really mattered and being around these amazing people, it was like, I felt so complete. So I love it that it's my show and I get to say the final thank you. So I want to thank you both for lots of things, for the work you do, for the contribution you make to our community, to our country, and to the planet, because that's what you're doing, for fighting the good fight and for caring enough to show up today with your passions, your insights, your chart, your data set, because it all matters.
Did I hear delusion in there someplace?
Delusion. No, I don't think there was any delusion there. You behave, mister. For using your big brains to make good things happen, all of which gives me hope at a time when I will tell you I need it. I need to be infused with hope, because what I read and what I know is daunting. And it's hard sometimes for me. So when I prep for a show like this and the ones I did this week, it's like, there is hope. Look at these amazing people. So I'm truly honored that I got to spend the time with both of you. And I mean that from my heart. And thanks to you, our wonderful listeners, is always my final thanks, because it's so obvious that clearly without you, there would be no us. So thank you all for being a part of my world.